Hello, everybody. It's Jughead, and thank you for waiting these 1 or 2 weeks for this next episode, which I'm very super, super excited about. I'd like to thank my friend Sam for introducing me to Jason Narducci and making this episode possible. Sam is a Patreon member, which is a good segue for me to say, please join my Patreon and support the show and donate to Jughead's Basement at the $2, $5, or $10 tiers. Every month you pay $2, $5, or $10 and you get varying degrees of free shit. Some shit brought to you via the mail and some shit brought to you via the internet. You get unedited videos of all of my interviews and you also get writings that I am doing based on a book I plan to put out sometime in the future, a photo book with short stories about all the bands I've been in, including Screeching Weasel, The Mopes, Even in Blackouts, The Mitochondriacs, and my new band, Semi-Famous. If you can't donate to the show, I understand. You can actually do it at one large lump of money, like if you just get your check on a Friday from work and say, hey, I can donate $50 right now, but I can't donate $2 or $5 or $10 a month. I can do it all right now. You can do that. You can pay for a year in advance and get all the free shit without having to worry about paying for it monthly. So go to www.jugheadsbasementpodcast.com and help out. Once again, like always, if you can't do that, that's okay with me. This show, ultimately, I like being free on the internet. It only takes about maybe 1% of my audience to chip in, and that'll help actually run the show for a year. If I actually had, like, out of the 3,000 people that listen to it, 1% donate, that would be amazing. But like I said, if you can't do that, there's free things to do, like share your favorite episode with friends or enemies or aliens from another planet or another galaxy, more likely. Or you can write a one-time review at Apple Music or wherever you get your podcasts, or just give a star review, 4 or 5. That would be nice. Okay, there we have it. Let's dig in. Let's go. Listening to Holiday by Verbo off their album Chronicles, produced by Bob Mould in 1997. Hello and welcome to Jughead's Basement, episode number 183 of Lo-Fi Interviews with Hi-Fi Guests. This week with Jason Narducci of Verboten, Verbo, Split Single, The Bob Mould Band, and Superchunk, and more. In this episode, we talk about such things as Cheap Trick and Budokan, being a team player sounds corny but true, how our fathers introduced us to things we probably should not have seen, Verboten to Verbo, the gift of band camaraderie, touring REM's Murmur with Michael Shannon, Time for Family, On Albini and Electric Audio, gushing over John Ross Bowie and Bob Mould, plus much, much Evanston, Chicago, Morton, Moore, Grove, more, more, more!
Hi.
Can you hear me, John?
I can hear you very well.
Sorry, still sorting a couple things out here.
That's fine. Sorting is fine.
How's that? Is that okay?
That's
some warm tones. Is this
it's perfect.
Okay?
You have a little bit of a yellow hue going over the whole screen, but that's nice. It's very calming.
Give me another 10 minutes and let me work on this.
Oh, no, you don't. No, it looks.
I'm just kidding.
I know you're a witty one. I've learned from that, but I am too. So maybe we'll
Excellent.
Never know when either of us are serious.
So you're in Japan?
I am in Japan. Yes, I'm looking at a nice, beautiful 9 a.m. day here in Japan. Yeah.
Where in Japan?
Osaka.
Oh, beautiful. I played there with Superchunk in 2019.
Oh, I was watching a lot of interviews, and this must have been pre that, because you had said you had never been to Japan yet.
Once. There's talk about more. I hope it happens. I really, that was maybe my favorite experience as a touring musician, just as far as experiencing a completely, you know, feeling like you're in a completely different world.
Yeah, and the way they receive concerts are very different too. I mean, they're super fans, but I don't. Did you experience the silence between songs? Like,
Yeah, I know. But then also like crazy excitement in other ways. You know,
yeah, that's just what I'm saying. They're really interesting. Yeah. They're very, you know, it's a stereotype, but it's true. The respectfulness of them is like overwhelming, almost to the point where like you have a rowdy song and then it's over and then it's just like silent.
You can hear it on you can hear it on, you know, Cheap Trick Budokan. It's like just total mayhem and then
I guess we had that. You and I are around the same. You're about my sister's age, which is about 5 years younger than me, but we all had those experiences of those records that came out.
You look great for 67.
67. That puts you at 60. So, wow, we both look amazing. No, but a lot of those records, you know, there was Budokan and then there was the Kiss one too. And there was other ones that were even Deep Purple were all like these Japanese like live records that seemed to be a thing when we were growing up.
I was super fortunate to record with Bunny Carlos. He had a solo record. This was maybe 8 years ago or something, but I fortunately know the guy who was producing the record and he brought me in for some songs.
Wow.
And you know, at the time and still maybe a little bit, but there's a little bit of a split between the Nielsens and I should say the whole band and Bunny, which is unfortunate. So I had actually asked the Nielsens for permission because I didn't want to upset them. And they were like, go have fun. It's all good. But I kind of had my guard up a little bit with Bun until he started talking about Budokan and the crazy thing about Budokan is that they almost didn't play I Want You to Want Me.
And this next song is called I Want You to Want Me.
They were so angry with how poorly the label had promoted that song. They thought it was a hit song and the label just couldn't get any radio. So they're like, fuck it, we're not going to play it at this show.
Wow.
And
that's like
seconds before they went on and like, just throw it on there, just do it. And that's the song that broke them.
Yeah, I'll probably jump to an audio clip of that because that's what I do on my show is I add little sound bites. So
I know you do. And I was going to ask if it would be okay if every once in a while I interjected from the future as well.
I would love that. I don't know if I can get it out by Tuesday, but
no, I'm going to do it actually in the moment. So there's going to be times when I get it wrong and I'm just going to jump in and go, this is Jason Narduzzi. And at this moment, I'm going to be speaking for way too long about...
Yeah, we'll have it. Like a one an hour and a half interview will be turned into like a 4 hour like
right.
Meta interview about the interview.
If we had to make corrections for everything, it's going to be a long haul.
Yeah,
for me, not you.
This isn't even one of my questions, but I'm curious because this is how my brain works too. We're both involved in music, and you've dabbled in theater, and of course, a lot of your videos are very like scene oriented. I worked for the theater a company called the Neo Futurists. I don't know if you know them. We did a show called Too Much Light Makes the Baby Go Blind. Which
should I call you John or Jughead? What do you prefer?
Well, John is good. But
John, yeah. I think we were in the same room.
That's what I want to say, Jason, is because I to be honest with you, I did not know of you. I knew of all the things you've done because of I know those bands.
But someone from one of my Patreons requested you, and then I started studying.
That's so sweet.
Yeah, oh then I God. Started studying you, and I'm like, well, we have like these, we have these like amazing overlaps that basically like throwing me for a loop as to how to approach this. But I feel like it'll just happen. But the thing I was going to get at is, do you think this I don't know, knowledge that you have of these things force of mine into a little bit of meta, or is it like our age range that does that, like that comment on not only being in the moment but being able to comment on that moment at the same time? Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how to answer that. I'm not sure. I mean, I feel like, you know, my dad and I spent a lot of time watching comedy, you know, Buster Keaton and Monty Python and Albert Brooks, and he was a great sort of tutor, you know, by example, by exposing me to this great work. And so that was always an aspiration. You know, you see these people being funny, you want to be funny. I remember in second grade, I tried to like improv this thing in class, and I got some of the kids to laugh, and I was just on, you know, just on cloud nine, you know. But I never had an outlet for that. And I also got really shy and really insecure. So it wasn't really until, honestly, like touring around with a lot of time and a lot of boredom and having John Worster sitting next to you.
John in the future, a little bit about Jonathan Patrick Worster, born October 31st, Halloween, 1966. He is an American drummer and comedy writer. As a musician, he is best known for his work with Superchunk, The Mountain Goats, Bob Mould, and of course, Jason Narduzzi. He is also known for appearing on The Best Show with Tom Sharpling. Back to the present.
We're just like being silly together and posting the dumbest, like, you know, like social media will remind you what you posted 12 years ago. Yeah. It's like, oh.
Yes, the home show will be there forever.
Right, I know. Well, I'm proud of that because that was like crisis. That's like we're locked in.
Our pandemic is definitely all over the internet, like what we were dealing with and what we did.
I mean, I haven't watched it, but I don't mind being vulnerable about that, because that was truly me and my family just making stuff up in the moment, and it felt like we did okay.
Yeah, you know? I think that's what was heartwarming about it is getting having your kids in it was really nice to see, like that, and them playing along with that humor too.
They're both so funny. I mean, both of them have been in theater, and both of them are musicians, and so. We have a natural, you know, language with that, I think. But to answer your question, I don't know. I mean, I'm not in comedy. I just occasionally try to think of something that entertains me and my friends.
Yeah.
And you know, whether it's like a music video for a split single or just a short little minute long thing I remember once I shot something with my son where I walk into his room, I'm gonna have like a heart to heart with him, and he goes, "Dad, I don't want to talk about Cheap Trick right now." And people really liked it, and we had fun. You know, he and I can laugh about it. And I don't know. It's just a way to, you know, make the days go by a little bit easier.
Yeah, there are some really nice moments with him and your daughter that were pretty great in that. I'll share a common thing that I feel like is my father left when I was five. So my mom raised like five kids on her own, and my dad.
My dad would
come in occasionally, you know, and.
This is in the suburbs of Chicago?
Mount Prospect. Yeah. So when he would show up, there were special moments, and he would take us to movies. Like I saw all the like Mel Brooks movies when they came out, like Young Frankenstein.
Yeah.
He would take me to all that stuff that, you know, you're not supposed to take a little kid to.
Oh, my dad did that way too much. Yeah. My dad took me to see Dirty Harry when I was seven. I was like,
"Well, a naked man is chasing a woman through an alley with a butcher knife and a heart on it. I figure he isn't out collecting for the Red Cross."
And he realized that halfway through, he's trying to distract me with math problems and stuff. And I'm like, "Get out of the way. I want to see this guy's face get blown off." You know, parenting in the 70s.
Yeah. I mean, my first thing, A Naked Woman, was with my dad in a movie called, I think, Tribute, a Jack Lemmon movie, like a later Jack Lemmon movie.
Oh, I don't know that one.
Tribute is a 1980 Canadian comedy drama film directed by Bob Clark and starring Jack Lemmon as Scotty Templeton, a terminally ill Broadway agent trying to make amends with his family and friends.
But this naked woman jumps out of a birthday cake, and I was like, "That's the first time I've seen that."
Yeah. Thanks, Dad. I think you and I were in the same room because in the 90s, I had a band called Verbo, Chicago band called Verbo. As the summer closes, I need the cleansing wash on my chalkish body. Wash it. I know that I'm making a mark. We were just on our last legs around 01 or 02, but we got asked to play at Metro for the fundraiser for your theater company.
Oh, yeah. 30 bands in 30 60
bands
minutes.
In 60 minutes. We were one of those bands. We played No Action by Elvis Costello from this year's model because it's 2 minutes long.
And that's the one where I think Even in Blackouts. Yeah, I had Even in Blackouts play. My band actually played then too.
So we were definitely in the same room, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
That's fine.
Wow. I had wondered if we were ever actually in the same room.
Yeah.
We've been in. Oh, so let's do that. So you're from Evanston, which is just like a rock throw away from where I grew up. And, you know, we used to go all the way to when we were younger in high school, would go up to what's that area called? That's you can go to the beach there.
The ravines.
Like where all the, yeah, yeah. But we would go.
The ravines are the Sheridan Road where it's really.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's
really what
beautiful
you mean?
Area. So. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And my mother was from Evanston, too. So I have a little soft spot in my heart
for
Evanston. I don't even know. I've never talked to her directly where she was, but then her family moved to Morton Grove, which is where my grandma lived, where I knew them from. But also I thought it was interesting that you worked, your show was with a house theater, which I've worked with the Neo Futures, but we also did a show together called Alice in Evanston.
Oh, wow. Where was that?
Alice was a show that was was a site-specific show. We would actually have each chapter of the book in different stores all over Evanston.
Wow.
And I did the bookstore, the main bookstore that was there. I can't remember the name of it now. It's really, you walk in and it's on the corner and it has magazines all over the place and then books.
Bookends and Beginnings.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's it. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Very cool.
Look at this. John in the future is pretty busy here. I also want to clarify, like Jason will do in just a moment, in the future of this podcast, but in your present, the Alice that the house theater was involved in was at the Neo Futurist Theater in Andersonville, which happened in 2004. The reboot done by Noelle Krim and her company Upended Productions was the one done in Evanston in September and October of 2018.
There was room in there to do a performance? It's pretty tight quarters.
Yeah, well, I was in the back area, stuffed in the back, and I was the, what did I do then? I did the Caterpillar. That's right. I did. I'm just wondering if that influence and being that close to the city, because I know, like, we both played Batteries Not Included, which was, to me, I thought was like the city, but that was more like the north side, like Lincoln Park, which is not, you know, like technically like the dirtier part of the city, but it was such an adventure to go from like the suburbs into there. But you were closer. So did you have more of an intimate relationship, you think, with like the Chicago scene and Chicago bands when you were?
This is Jason Narducci interjecting on the podcast to say that at earlier podcasts, he thought he played at Batteries Not Included when in fact it was Club Dreamers on 1516 North Milwaukee with a horrible stairwell to carry up amps. I confirmed that with a friend on Facebook today. Yeah, my friend Jamie Hesby and Zach Kenner, the drummer from Verboten, in 1989 or 90, I think it was the summer of 89, we got a gig at Club Dreamers. I was terrified, even though there was maybe 20 people in the audience, but I was just very intimidated and I hadn't built up the confidence post Verboten. You know, you watch video of Verboten and I'm 11 and I'm super confident and just like, hey, this is easy, you know. And then you go through puberty and you're like, oh, there's a lot of good musicians out there. You know? Yeah. So was it turned out a punk that I said Batteries Not Included? I don't remember
which
podcast.
It might have been. Yeah.
It was Club Dreamers. Yeah.
Yeah.
But we played Cubby Bear. Verboten played Cubby Bear.
Yeah, I know that. Yeah. I'll probably throw that video up on the site too, because it's pretty amazing to see you at 10 or 11 that stage with Naked Rig on, one of my generation's one of our favorite punk bands.
Absolutely.
A force to behold.
Yeah.
Yeah. I actually just interviewed John Haggerty just a couple weeks ago. So
excellent.
What a nice, just calm fellow.
Great guy. And they had some Evanston connections too.
Well, I know Kesdy, the Kesdy boys.
Yeah, yeah, they lived. Yeah, he was doing contracting work, living in Evanston later, not during the heyday of the band.
I just get back to, yeah, Club Dreamers. That's one of the first places too that Screeching Weasel, my band, played.
Really?
And my friend's car was stolen at that show, and he's the one that drove us all with the equipment.
The equipment wasn't in there though.
No, equipment was not in there. No, but we then had, you had no I way to get how we, yeah, yeah, we had yeah. no way to get it back. I think we had to call in some special friend calls to get it taken care of.
Yeah, what a time.
Yeah, and that place burned down a little bit later. But yeah.
Club Dreamers was located at 1516 North Milwaukee Avenue in Wicker Park from 1986 to 1993. It did burn down, and I'm pretty sure that's what closed it, but I'm not 100% sure.
I'm going to be all over the place, Jason, here. But one of the things that when I was reading that very interested me is you did Verboten, and then, like you talk about, you did for 2 years, and then you kind of just did your school thing. You know, you took basketball, and you returned to music. And Furbo, which was originally just you and Al, it was just called Jason and Allison. Was that right, originally?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah.
We started in 93 when I was 22.
Yeah. Almost exactly like 10 years.
I was playing, but it was not, there weren't releases, and I had some high school bands. We play shows. A lot of them was Zach from Verboten. He continued with me. We played in a band called On in Chicago, and we would do pretty well. We could sell out, you know, Shuba's and Beat Kitchen and Elbow Room and rooms like that. But I really got traction with Allison when I kind of ended On, which was a pretty traditional rock band, and just started playing acoustic with Allison. That's when I was able to get, you know, noticed a little bit.
Yeah. My curiosity, Jason, was the similarity in name over like a 10-year period. Was that a conscious decision to like take your name, but add the bow, like cello to it?
Right. Well, that's why that was, but believe it or not, I did not think of that. So when Allison and I started playing together, we were Jason and Allison. We released a record. We toured a lot. I was just talking to somebody, I had forgotten about this, but we actually, in April of 95, just, you know, like 5 months after the release of that record, we opened for Morphine at First Avenue. Sometimes you do these shows and you just forget about like things that happen.
John of the Future, something visual happened here. I actually had the word Morphine written on my notes, so I stuck it up to the computer screen for Jason to see.
You had that on there.
Well, I have Morphine on there.
Yeah,
My sister was intimate friends with Mark Stammen, so
he was something else.
Yeah. So I'm sorry to interrupt your story.
I've seen Dana a couple times in Boston. We're not in touch, but I like him a lot, and he's a massive talent. I would like to actually reach out to him and see if he has any memory of that, because Alice and I are coming up on the 30th anniversary of the release of that record, and we might do some shows around it, but. Yeah, we toured with Bob Mould. We toured, and then we came up with a band name, which was Skinny, because between the two of us, we were probably 180. You know? Like, and we just thought it was funny. Like, we walk on stage with a guitar and a cello, we're super skinny, and it just turned out this artist had that name, and so we had to come up with a name very last minute when we signed with Epic with Sony. And we came up with Verbo. They did not like the name, and I understand that now in retrospect. Mm. But it's hard to come up with band names, and
especially on them in the moment like that.
There wasn't a lot of time.
Encapsulate your band just in a spontaneous moment.
It's hard. I mean, even at that time, it was like bands were called like Fountains of Wayne, you know, which I think is a fine band. Not a great band name, you know.
Bowling for Soup. That's right. One of my friends' bands, Jared. That's right. Not a very good name.
No, but we know who they are. You know, it didn't get in the way. I know. I mean, I do remember telling myself, like, it doesn't have to be a great name, because there's plenty of bands with just whatever names that do fine. A weird time.
Yeah, we tried to get away from the band name Screeching Weasel. Like, 89, we broke up and then reformed, and we sort of hooked up with that Lookout crowd, you know, with where Green Day and Operation Ivy were from. And Larry basically said, well, you're going to do it under that name or I won't I won't put it out for you. So we
it's pretty good name.
I didn't have a problem with it, but yeah, Ben had just didn't like it.
So. Yeah.
But I think it sort of represents the screechiness of our band.
Yeah. No, it is a good band name, but it's so tricky to have perspective, you know.
Yeah. It's funny, Jace, because it's one of those like meanings of names things are usually what I usually avoid those conversations, but it's so interested me that you 10 years later, there's a reminiscent name of the band that's within this band. And it's very, well, to me, very different. Like it almost shows your growth over that time of like doing a Verboten and you were basing it on.
Well,
the
Tracy thought of the Verboten name. I mean, I think we all were kind of like, put an umlaut on there because we love Husker Du and Blue Oyster Cult.
Yeah.
I had not yet heard Motorhead, but I love Blue Oyster Cult and I loved Husker Du.
Well, Motley Crue does that too, you know.
Yeah, they were not around yet. Were not in 83, were they?
I don't know. Yeah, maybe.
They weren't on
Motley Crue's first album, Too Fast for Love, came out in 1981, followed by Shout at the Devil in 1983.
They weren't on my radar and I was never a fan, so that would not have been.
That's my sister's generation stuff.
Yeah. But Tracy thought of that, and then I came up with Verbo because it was, you know, the Spanish word for to take action is V-E-R-B-O. So I thought take action, but with the reference to the cello would be a nice tip of the hat to Allison. And people remembered it, but then there was all these other companies that came out later called Verbo with I don't know what type of company it was, but it was V-E-R-B-O. And then it got confusing very quickly. But... Yeah, what are you going to do?
Yeah, I just want to say that it's a lot to inhale your music in like a week or two.
There's too much. There's too many.
It's too much. I would like you to go back and unrecord some of those.
Literally worked with my publicist at trimming down the bio because people get so confused. I just saw a throat doctor because I don't know if you can hear it, but I'm struggling with my voice. I'm about to go on tour with Bob for 3.5 weeks.
Yeah.
Solo shows where I open up for Bob, I play for 45 minutes. I need my voice. The good news is that I'm now just starting a treatment I think is going to help. And the even better news is that somehow I have no polyps or nodules, which after 42 years of singing rock is baffling to me. I don't know how that's even possible, but you can hear like I could, you know, do like a soprano's voiceover right now. And that's not full capacity for, you know, control and range, unfortunately, for singing. But yeah, for doing it for 42 years, there's a lot there. And it keeps on adding, you know, like a year ago, I started
You keep on making shit.
Or I keep on touring, you know, like a year ago, I started playing with Sunny Day Real Estate. And then that just adds to the like, which I'm so thankful for. I'm so thankful to have work like that. But it gets confusing.
You've joined a lot of bands to help them out on bass, which is not your first instrument. It's guitar, which is, I think, interesting too, that you seem to be doing these appearances in other bands that you respected, Superchunk and Bob Mould. And are you playing bass in that band too?
Guitar.
Right. Oh, you are going to guitar on that one.
Yeah.
A little part got cut out there. Jason will be playing guitar in Sunny Day Real Estate.
But I was curious as to the only one now that you've made the transition, and then get me if I'm wrong, that is in recording is Bob Mould, right? Is he the only one you're actually in the studio recording with? Bands that you play with?
I have a solo project called Split Single. We record records.
Yes, I know. I'm going to get to that. But I'm saying with you, like joining
as a band member thing. That's the only band. Yeah, it's true. Yeah. Bob. That band is the only one that I record with besides my own solo stuff. Yep.
What do you think it is? I don't know if you want to go there. Sometimes I turn into a therapist, psychologist during these interviews, but this is the story you've told about how Bob brought you into the band is great. And you've told it many times and I'll probably refer to it. You know, you just kind of showed up at a lot of his shows and then eventually became friends. And then
he accidentally, super fan.
And then he accidentally found out about you because what someone was recommended your band, Jason and Allison, to open up. And then he's like, oh, I know Jason.
Yeah.
So I guess so that story is really cool, but I'm really curious as to why do you think these people open up to you to bring you in into like a package that, and you stay with them for a long time. In my mind, it almost takes precedence over your own material in some ways, like your commitment to these other bands, and then you come back and record when you can. I'm just interested in that. Two things, your reasoning, and then, but also what about you? Do you think these people just have you back all the time?
The Verbo experience was really healthy for me because we went through a lot of bassists and a lot of drummers. And so you learn how to like, okay, I'm the leader of the band. How can I make them feel comfortable? What can I do to help them learn the songs? What can I do to help put a show together? And then when you become that other person and you've got a leader who's talking to you, I think I have a pretty good perspective on what they're looking for. I would mm-hmm. hope. So my goal is always to be a pleasant person to travel with, you know, like a respectful person, someone who, you know, I try to check in with Mac, with Superchunk about like, we've got this coming up. Do you need me to do this? Or like, do you have an idea of, like, we just started playing with a new drummer with Superchunk, Laura King. She's amazing. This is her first tour that we just wrapped up. We did 8 shows in 9 days on the East Coast, and she just like killed the crowd. The crowds loved her. But to get to that point as her partner in the rhythm section, what can I do? So I'd reach out to Mac and go, well, do you have a song list? And then I'd come back to Laura and talk about these songs and just let me know what you're thinking. And she'd be like, can you look at me before the bridge? You know, just that kind of stuff. Just try to be a good band member. Just try to be a team player. That sounds corny. It sounds corporate or something, but there's a lot to that, you know, because I don't see enough people recognizing or writing about how being a touring band is, it looks glamorous and there are wonderful things about it, but it's actually relatively stressful. You know, not every backstage is comfortable. Maybe you didn't have enough time to take a shower or get the food you want, or you've called home and it wasn't a good call. We all have these moments. And so any way that somebody in the band can be helpful and supportive means a lot. And I am incredibly fortunate to be in the bands that I am in, because they're great people who get that. You know, I have tons of friends who are in other bands, and the stresses and the anxieties for them is tough. You know, I'm sure there's a lot of times where they're like, is this worth it? You know, yes, I'm in this big band, or yes, I'm in this band that does okay, but there's not a lot of joy. And I'm very fortunate that there is. Every band I'm in will walk off stage at some point and go, that was good. How about that?
Yeah.
How about that? You know, we played that song that we've never played. And did you see the person in the fourth row? You know, just all that kind of fun stuff about being in a band. So I'm so fortunate with that. But to answer your question, I think I don't always do that. I have my flaws and I have my bad days, but I really do try. And then with Bob Mould, it's a whole other level of friendship and connection, because, you know, he took me under his wing when I was 23 or something, and recorded the first Verbo record for, you know, he produced that first Verbo record when I was 25. So you've got your mentor working with you, and then we stay friends throughout all that. And then by the time I'm 34, I'm in his band, and now it's been 18 years. And it's just, I mean, I talked about for 45 minutes today, you know, like, so it's beyond just the band thing. Like we're close. And so that's a whole other level of familiarity, and also just kind of like playing a role as a friend and playing a role as a bandmate.
Jason, I acquaint that you said, this isn't about like your band and working with other bands, but it's a similar thing for me. Like many people would ask, I don't know if you know any history of Screeching Weasel, but we're known to have one of the biggest assholes in punk rock in Ben Weasel.
Frontman. Yeah.
But I would always get the questions like, you know, for 20 years, like, well, how could you be with that person for so long? And I knew he's a kind
it's
of
performance
avoided.
Art.
It's
performance art.
Yeah. You know, he's my friend.
He wasn't doing that backstage, was he? Next question. Hi, this is Jason Arduzzi, and you're about to hear me say something that
put
John in a little bit of a tight spot.
No, I'm always really open about that stuff. I think he always had anxiety, and he was able to use his anxiety to rile up an audience. Like his reaction, if someone in the audience, like if he was always kind of anxious, so that built his like personality on stage. But then if something went wrong in the audience, in order to deal with it, to deal with his anxiety, he had to do the Don Rickles thing where, you know, attack. Instead of avoiding it or moving away, he would attack.
Yeah.
So that became more of his personality over time. You know, like
it. Well, and your 10 o'clock only headlining thing is just fascinating. I mean, that to me, maybe I'm wrong, but that feels like another facet of anxiety, like another way to protect from pressures. These are our rules. This is the only way we'll do it. Sometimes it works. Sometimes it's a massive challenge.
Yeah. So the audience, I think they probably know because most of them know the history of my band, but we had contracts at like when we weren't even known yet. I booked all the tours ourselves.
You would send the club's contracts.
Yeah, we would send the club's contracts. And so most of them were like kids renting moose halls and stuff.
Yeah.
And it was about, we had to have monitors, not playing after 10, all ages.
Right.
So it took out a lot of places that we could possibly play.
But dream setup. Like that's, I would love that now. You know, like if every show could be at 7 p.m.
To be honest, it kind of built our reputation. It helped build our reputation of being troublesome, but that troublesome is also what people like to hear about.
Yeah.
But the good cop, bad cop was ridiculous because Ben would basically, I'm the one who had to send the contracts to all the people and I'd do that and talk through it. And I'm like, oh, you don't need monitors. I go, man, you need monitors. My singer is screaming.
Yeah.
You know, even if you have to get like two like speakers, you know, from your stereo, just put them near my singer, you know, like, and it was my job that when we got to the venue, like Ben's job was, he would ask him, do you have this? As soon as they said no to one, he would just walk away, like leave, go into the van. And then it was my job to try to figure out how to deal with this situation.
I bet you would be an amazing tour manager.
I toyed with the idea, but I don't know. I like performing too much myself to do that, to watch someone else do it every
year.
but what I was getting at with that is that they, so I did have to deal with a lot of intense situations over the years. And then we didn't become a touring band. It was just basically running the company of Weasels Inc. And, you know, I did all the taxes and all the accounting and stuff. But what really helped me balance that was theater. Like I for a while I was a record for every play that I did. I do a play and then I'd have a record. I was like 15 for 15 for like a long period of time.
Amazing.
So one of the answers to that question was that separation of this was my ego project, which was the theater. Then I could easily fall into the second person in charge, you know, in this band and just do it like without even a second thought.
Yeah.
You know? So I don't know if that's your feelings, but I think that balance of having your own projects, but then being able to just be the second in charge or
the one that's there
to try to fill in an ensemble, make an ensemble is really nice balance that you have.
Trying, you know, the split single thing came up because I could see that there would be ebbs and flows in the touring schedule that I had zero influence on. And I had lost my confidence for songwriting. I'd done a little bit, you know, after Verbo ended in like 2002 or so, three, something like that. And I did an EP in 2004 and I just hadn't written anything. So I started back doing that in 2012. And I realized if I could write some decent songs, I've met all these musicians touring for the last however many years, people that I get along with, people I admire, people I, really look up to. So it could be, I mean, that's why Split Single maybe is a good band name, because it's that sharing where it's like, you know, Single. And so I could learn from other musicians, we could collaborate, and I'd also just try to make it simple. The Split Single songs are simple. And then when I'm not touring with these other bands, I could do shows on my own. And that's been really rewarding. I love going back into that. And then now with this whole, you know, living room show culture that I wasn't privy to until maybe 6 or 7 years ago. And I love it now. We're talking about early shows. You know, you play at 8 o'clock for 75 minutes to a room of seated people, and it's done at, you know, 9:15, and you're selling some merch, hopefully, and then you're done at 10. And I love it. I love that. Bob Mould and I are about to do a tour where it's like small theaters, clubs, performing arts centers. I love those too. It's early shows, sit down crowd, listening crowd. You know, Bob Mould, of course, has this amazing musical crowd who just are so in tune and so loyal and so into the type of music that we all love in our orbit. And so Split Single is an amazing outlet for me in that way. So that's how that came about, and I'm really enjoying doing that.
In 2001, I started Even in Blackouts, which was an acoustic punk band, but the idea was that we could play Even in Blackouts. And, so in 2001, we would do these tours where I would book like big venues based on my reputation with Weasel. But then I would also book these house shows. So back in 2001, I was doing this. And the idea was the person had to pay us $100 and make us dinner.
Love it.
And I did those all over the country, and it was so amazing, very intimate. And we ended up ironically making more money at those because the intimate audience would buy everything.
It's like... so true. Well, and so, I don't know if this was your experience, but for me, like, I get to tell stories, you know, like,
yeah. We would do, we'd hang out, tell stories. I love that.
Yeah. And it's just a completely different presentation instead of like the stage and the lights and the, you know, big production. It's just, you're just standing right there. And so you can kind of like, I think people just feel more in tune to it. And now it's moved towards like, people go, well, if I buy this ticket for this living room show for $25, I'm going to be seated the whole time. I'm going to bring my own drinks. I'm not going to pay $10 for a beer. Mm-hmm. And this is not any diss on any clubs. I love playing clubs, but it's a different experience. It's a different experience. Mm-hmm. You know, you bring your own six pack and you pay $25 and you sit there and you see somebody perform this unique presentation with very stripped down. And then you meet them and you maybe take a picture or you buy something. And it's just this completely different concert experience. And now across the country, there's all these amazing hosts who do these things. And, you know, people like David Bazan and Eric Bachman and all these, you know, musicians that I look up to who are amazing songwriters do a lot of those shows as part of their livelihood. I do too now, you know, and it's a beautiful thing that is, there are so many things I don't like about social media and that I complain about social media, but it allows me a platform to promote shows like that. And I'm very, very thankful for that.
This makes also think that I'm still connected, even though I don't play as much, with the punk scene that's still alive, like in the underground scene. And one of the amazing thing that happened once, like Nirvana and Green Day, like busted it into the mainstream, you know, sometimes that kills a scene, but in many ways, like with punk, it just drove it back deeper down, like, you know, like once it fell out of the mainstream. And now it's a community all over the world. Like I'll go and play with a band, and like I like to offer my guitar to like bands that were influenced by Weasel will invite me to play Weasel songs, and then I'll play their songs with them. Like I'll learn their catalog.
So cool.
And I got to go to Costa Rica, I went to Amsterdam, Italy, all these places. And
beautiful.
What's great is all these small bands all know each other, like from all over the world.
Yeah.
So I guess what I'm getting at is these living room shows, you can make some money at it, but I don't think that's the point for like the big musicians who do it. There's this community that builds within that. Like, a one-to-oneness that you can't get as easily in like a big venue. I mean, you get that energy of playing a room of 3,000 people, but you don't get that intimacy that you lose. And I think coming up in theater, I miss that intimacy. And that's why I started doing these living room shows too.
Oh, cool. I love it. Yeah.
I just want to say, Jason, that not just this, because I'm saying a lot already, Verbeau, I love it. I love it.
Oh,
I love
wow,
it.
Thank you.
You know, we come from some of the same influences. You even said it, but I'm pretty sure you probably are followed Mitch Easter and that whole thing. And I know you're big into REM and all that, and those influence and Morphine, and this idea of introducing like a bowed instrument into some punky yet pop feel was really brilliant. And making it a little bit more complicated, which then I, once again, I looked up the word woodshed because that was your first thing. And I was like, oh, that means like working on something complicated in back scenes so that you can make it seamless when you're showing it to people. That's the one I dug into the most. I'm now like hitting split single. But if I'm able to analyze your different music, that one for some reason is easier for me to grab onto. Split single is great. And it's more like you have your Cheap Trick and pop punk influences, but in first listenings, they all seem to blend in more together. Whereas I thought Verbeau, every song kind of had like this, their own flavor.
Oh, interesting.
I'm giving you a criticism, but I like them both, but I think it's very interesting that band was very intricate and yet on the surface of it, very easy to listen to.
Okay.
So yeah, that's going to stick with me, that one. And now I'm working on split single to get that to stick with me more.
I think the most recent one is my best batch of songs, Amplificato. I miss you. But I'm proud of all of it. I you know, the Verbeau stuff, I was very fortunate to have Bob produce the first one and then Brad Wood produced the second one. And I think they did an amazing job. I wish I had someone in my life, it didn't necessarily have to be a producer, it could have been me, who would say, okay, that's the first draft of lyrics. What are you trying to say in this song? I feel like I've gotten much better at that. If you look at the split single songs, there's... I just maybe a stronger storyteller. I got a little bit lazy on some of the Verbeau stuff, but I'm proud of it, and I'm friends with all those guys still. And Allison, of course, Allison and I just had lunch last week. I mean, I don't know if you feel this way, but I enjoy trying to get better. Being a songwriter, which is so challenging at times, it can be so heartbreaking. It can be so hard. But there are things that you can remind yourself of. There's things that you can, it's funny, I started doing more production stuff in Chicago because between March and August, I didn't have any tours. So I, very little touring. So I kind of offered myself up to produce bands and I got six projects out of that. And that was incredibly helpful for me because I'm saying out loud to these people what I'm recommending when I could use the same advice myself, you know. Some of it's just so basic, you know, just about arrangements and about telling a story. And does this verse need to be this long? Just, you know, efficiency is goes a long way. When you have a good idea, you don't have to like kill somebody with it in 5 minutes. You could probably do it in three. So I really enjoy that process. And are you writing for the acoustic band?
Even in Blackouts, right now I am not. We did an album a few years ago. We had a 10-year hiatus and then did another record that was, I think, our favorite, but I am not. But my challenge in that band was that every time we decided to do a record, I had to learn something new. That was like one of my rules. I had,
whether
it was like an instrument, like the mandolin, or a new chord. Like one album, I just learned a bunch of swing chords that I can't even remember now anymore, but I learned them for that record.
That's what a great, I love guardrails like that. You know, that's so cool.
Yeah. And we had a singer, Liz is a choir trained vocalist. So once she started, because I was a rudimentary guitarist at best. And then once that she could actually harmonize with herself and do all this stuff, I was like, oh my God, I gotta bump up my game.
That's so cool. She inspired you.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, to this very day. I think we're almost touching on it. Let me see if I wrote it down here on my many notes, but let me see if I can make an actual question out of it. I'll say what I wrote down and then we'll see where that goes. Does music guide your lyrical content emotion and sound taking lead over words first. I wrote this down when I started listening to Split Single, because even though, like you said, you were simplifying, even in the art movement, simplifying is misleading because it often means you have to go through this process of complexity in order to simplify.
That's deconstruction.
Haiku. Like haiku is not just throwing together three lines. It's like it's contemplation and meaning. But what I did notice is that the chord changes, and you have an interesting way of, it's always been difficult for me where you'll like jump a chord change or something, or there's a little movement in between, which with your up and down stroking is pretty amazing. It's really great. So I just wondered whether in some ways when you're writing, whether the emotional content like guide the music you're doing, both lyrically and musically, like how does emotion play into how you write as a creative person?
Well, I always do lyrics last, and often the music will kind of dictate that, you know, like what is this, you know. Sometimes it can be as simple as like when I walk on stage, you know, you kind of imagine like I've written this new song. I really like the music. I like the melody that I wrote with dummy lyrics. I do that. I don't know if you do that, where you're just like, but what would I like to convey while I'm experiencing that song? So sometimes that can dictate a first step towards a lyric or a first word or a first emotion. But, and you know, like if it's like a really slow acoustic thing, there's certain lyrics that you're not going to sing because it would sound so.
But
I think it does often dictate it. Sometimes you can have fun with it. Like I have this song on the last Split Single record that was, for me, no one else has said this, but for me, to my ears, it was the most like, oh, you tried to write an REM song because Mike Mills is playing bass on this record, which I totally was. I was like, I've already written all these songs, but what's a song that's like so in Mike's pocket that he'll just like take off, which he did, really cool. But I never brought it up. It's the first time I've even talked about it. So I had the music and I had the melody and I had to have a temporary title so we knew what song we were talking about. So I called it Jangle Tusk, because it's a jangly song, as REM. So many of REM songs were jangly. And the drum part reminded me of Tusk. So we recorded the music, and then those guys left, John Worster and Mike Mills left, and then I was left with overdubs and vocals. And the engineer, Taylor Hales, that I was working with over at Electrical Audio, is like, when are you going to sing Jangle Tusk? And I was like, oh, I don't have lyrics for that yet. And then the next day he's like, when are we going to get the jangle? He just kept on bringing it up. And I was like, Taylor, why do you keep asking about this song? He's like, I love the title. And I'm like, oh no, I wrote a better title than I can come up with lyrics for. So I tried like hell to come up with something around Jangle Tusk. I just couldn't, but I started moving things around and I came up with Mangled Tusk, which is about how I have to wear a night guard at night. Not a common topic for a rock song. Don't let me fade this way. Please, bloody gums and mangled tusk before morning light.
I guess I like talking about that stuff because as a writer too of songs, I feel like there, in my mind, I put into two categories. There's the one where I can write a song with lyrics and words that take about the same time to write it than it does to actually play it.
Like, that can work sometimes.
And then there's the ones where I'll sit with, like I wrote a song about called Dear Resonance, which is like based on John Lennon. But it's about my experiences in Germany when I was younger and realizing how for some reason, the resonance of Hitler and all that was still in the young generations. Like was it like five generations later, they were still affected by this. And it blew my mind that resonance of that would still affect these people. So basically I wrote a lot of notes and then I tried to jam them into a song. And what I noticed that I learned about that process is that it actually made me be even more creative with the music because I had to turn corners musically that I wouldn't have done if I were just naturally just playing something and singing
as a way to engage, or what was the purpose of messing with the chords that way?
Some of the lines were longer and I didn't want to change them. You know, or the thought had changed in my writing and I had to sort of mirror that in the structure of it.
That's cool.
So I think I feel like I see some of that in Verbo, and then it I guess it makes sense to me, like in Split Single, that it's very music driven and very very energetic. I'm starting to turn over to it. I just can't distinguish the songs as well.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Earlier band.
Yeah. There's on the first Verbo record, there's a song called River Wish, which was more of my approach to songwriting that was in the vein of Pete Townsend, where there would be five different parts. There's just many different parts, which I loved that about Pete Townsend. And then as I got older, I was like, you can convey this thing without having that much going on. And so that was one of the goals with Split Single, was to just kind of like efficiency, songwriting efficiency.
I know this is pretty off, maybe just a circumstance because you're on the road a lot. You can't dedicate yourself to the same people. But does that touring with these bands fill that ensemble feel for you? Like, do you miss being in a band that you are the leader of that is like the same group of people? Or is that not even, you had that in Verbo, and I don't know if you've had it since that way.
I'm fortunate to have a version of that in Chicago, where there's a group of Chicago musicians that we've kind of settled into this thing. For years, I was all over the place and asking people, and that was cool too, because I've met these great musicians. Do you want to do that? You know, my friend Eric Paparazzi from Cat Power did a West Coast swing with us in a KEXP performance, and he's just amazing. He's a pleasure to work with, but he lives in LA, you know, like I can't fly him in for every Split Single show in Chicago. So I have this really, really special group of friends and spectacular musicians, Billy, Dan, and Gerald in Chicago, that we've, you know, for the past, I think, 5 years or so, it's been us when we do shows. So I make the records with, you know, kind of whoever is available for that, and then try to do the local shows. It's just, it's financial, it's schedule. But these guys, just to give an example of how great they are to work with, in December, so this is just 9 months ago, Guided by Voices was scheduled to play three shows, maybe four shows in Evanston as part of a New Year's Eve celebration. They couldn't do the shows. They canceled last minute with about a week's notice. So the venue called me and I was like, yeah, Split Single will do one of those dates. And I reached out to the guys, are you guys available on this date? Yeah, but we're not available to practice before that because it's the holidays. So I said, okay, here's the songs that I'd like to do. If you could just work on them on your own. And then I want to encore with five Guided by Voices songs that we've never played. And we'll sound check them. That'll be our practice. And these badass dudes did it. And I was wondering if there would be a group of people there who had already bought the plane tickets, already bought the tickets to the show, who were just going to come to the show anyways. And sure enough, we did our set. It went great. And then we walk out for the encore, and I brought a case of Miller Lite, like Guided by Voices does, and a bucket of ice. We all opened up a beer, and we just did five Guided by Voices songs, and that crowd came all the way to the front, and we're just like, yeah. And I can't do that. I can't do that unless I have guys who are with me on that, who are not only like really good friends, who also take joy in that aesthetic and that challenge, and so. To your question, I'm very fortunate to have that.
Yeah, I have that with it took me a while, but through my experiences with Weasel and going through like 14 members, when I started even in Blackouts, it was, being a family was almost more important.
Yes.
And then when my members started having families, it felt very natural that was a part of it too.
Like, yeah.
We built a community. So when we did a show in Raduno Festival in Italy, we were second headlining with Dan Vapid, who was in Weasel with me, but he was going to do like Riverdale, Screeching Weasel, all these big bands that all these people were there to see. And he had passport trouble and couldn't make it. And we didn't find out until the day before. So I'm really proud of my band because I said, okay, well, we're going to do, they wanted us to headline, but like, they're all there to see them. I had my pocket of audience, but they were going to be there to see them. So we spent our whole day off that we were supposed to be traveling around Italy, and we sat in a studio and did like 10 Weasel songs. And
amazing.
Stuff like
that. Wow.
And the whole band just learned everything. And we had like rotating bands.
Who was
singing?
It's a lot of lyrics.
Well, that's what we had. We had rotating, because there were people from all over the world at the festival, like bands that I knew. So we would have rotating singers come up and sing for us that were like big fans also in bands playing there.
That's so cool.
And then Liz, my singer, we would do a couple of Weasel covers already. So she would do those ones. But it was really pretty amazing. Like,
yeah.
It's like, well, here's our great set that this is my band that I love. And here's what you guys want to see.
We both win.
Yeah, we both win. So I really do respect that idea of the, that's why I asked the question, because you seem like someone, even though you're really good to join all these bands and become friends with them, it seems like someone that like me that craves that familyness of a band.
Camaraderie.
With both the,
yeah,
it's the function and dysfunction.
You hear it from professional athletes that retire from the game, and they say, oh, you must miss the game. And they're like, I miss hanging out with the team more. And that's the thing, you know, to have that camaraderie with bandmates is such a gift.
I do want to hit what you have coming up soon, but, so I'm going to do let me do a change because I want to get here, but I want to bring REM and Murmur into this scene here, because that was another game changer for me when I was 83 in high school, and I had the Murmur record, and no one could understand what I was going crazy about.
Or what Stipe was singing about.
Well, I also learned over time, like the more I can understand Stipe, the less I tended to like the song. Because
no, he's great. He's great.
No, I love that. I love the music. Yeah. But so I'm interested in that influence on you, and then to end up working with some of them. And then you're doing this thing with Michael Shannon, which is like a whole nother crazy element of that. Of you did a show and now you're going to be doing a tour in February.
Yeah, there's so much about this that is out of left field. Well, yeah. I'm
give me the short
version of Michael Shannon is that we met through an amazing musician named Robbie Faulks, who's a Chicago musician who now lives in LA, but he's a folk and bluegrass artist that is just, you know, phenomenally talented, an amazing songwriter, insane guitar player, great singer. And he would do these Monday nights at the Hideout, where he would just every Monday night would be a completely different thing. And he wanted to do a Lou Reed record all the way through. He asked me to play bass and he asked Michael Shannon to, this is 10 years ago, to sing. And so we did that. That's the first time that Michael Shannon and I met. We did another one with Robbie, and then we were going to do a third one, and Robbie had moved to LA or couldn't do it or something. So Michael kind of leaned on me to put together a band. And we've just been doing these fun shows ever since, whether it's, you know, T-Rex or Dylan or Neil Young or, and in January of this year, we did the Modern Lovers first record, which is an amazing record.
So that's another one of my favorite records. Yeah.
What an album. That went great. And then I saw that Mike was coming into town in the summer, and I didn't have much going on. I was like, you want to do another show? And he's like, yeah, what do you want to do? And usually he comes up with them. Occasionally I will. But this time I was like, well, it's the 40th anniversary of Murmur. What do you think of that? He's like, oh, yeah. And then he was like, we have to do this at Metro. And to be completely candid, as much as I love Metro, and I've been very fortunate to play there a lot, you have to sell a lot of tickets at Metro make money. And what I want, if I'm hiring musicians, I want to at least pay them.
Right.
I mean, we learned 26 songs for one night. I want to pay them, you know?
Yeah.
And there's, it just can get tricky. And so he's like, it has to be at Space. I was like, okay, I'll call Joe Shanahan. It has to be at Metro. And I called Joe and he's like, you know, it's our 40th anniversary too. And I was like, I forgot about that. And now that you say it, wasn't REM the first band to play at Metro? He said, yep. I'm like,
I didn't even know that. Wow.
So it was just this story that was,
wow,
you know, undeniable. And sure enough, packed show and a beautiful special night. And then, you know, Mike Mills flies in and sings with us. It was just euphoric. I mean, it was one of those shows where, like, I have to admit, like, for weeks it resonated with me and it resonated with other people. I kept on getting messages or running into people on the street. And then in the meantime, we started getting offers from other cities. And I went back to Michael Shannon and I was like, is this something you want to do? I think we can keep it within, you know, a short window of time. And through the help of my friend Mahmood over at Concerted Efforts, who's a great booking agent. We put together this little mini tour, and it's exciting. It's a great Chicago band. I think Michael Shannon is a captivating performer with a great voice, and it's fun. And it's just so unique.
John in the future here. Jason has brought up Mike Mills a few times in this interview. So in case you don't know, Michael Edward Mills is an American multi-instrumentalist, singer, and composer who is a founding member of the alternative rock band REM. Though known primarily as the bass guitarist and backing vocalist of REM, his musical repertoire also includes keyboards and occasional lead vocals. He contributed to a majority of the band's musical compositions and is the only member to have had formal musical training. Also, most of you probably know who Michael Shannon is, but you may not know that even though from Kentucky, he also split time as a kid in Chicago and helped form a theater company called Red Orchid Theater, which many of my friends worked at, and he also worked with Steppenwolf. Most of you, of course, know him as General Zod in the latest Flash movie. He was up for a couple of Academy Awards, and his list of movies is almost endless, and TV shows like Boardwalk Empire, which I loved. The Michael Shannon and Jason Narduzzi tour of Murmur by REM will be from February 4th to February 14th of 2024, hitting such places as Minneapolis, Athens, Georgia, Carrboro, North Carolina, Washington, D.C., Ardmore, Pennsylvania, Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Brooklyn, New York. Back to me and Jason.
You probably don't need to do it to a cover thing as long as you don't record them, but do you have the blessing of the REM the folks like Mike? And
we were in touch with Burtis Downs, their manager, the whole time. And of course, yeah. Mike Mills and I are texting about it. I mean, they were never like, no. And the REM, you know, Twitter account and Instagram account helped promote the show. So it felt like supportive. And Mike Mills said really, really lovely things to us about how we performed. I mean, that's a lot of, I told Nick McCree, the bassist, you know, we practiced the day before and he walks into practice and I said, so you want me to tell you that Mike Mills is going to be at the show now, or do you want me to wait until tomorrow so you can sleep better? But he's like, so
theoretically.
Yeah. So I knew he could handle that. I wouldn't say that to somebody who couldn't handle it. And of course he was fantastic. And Mike Mills just showered him with compliments, but so it's a celebration is what it is. It's like, I think you said it, you know, there's so many people. I have a picture of me wearing an REM t-shirt when I'm 16 years old, you know, like that band changed, you know, like when people ask me best American bands, I'm always like REM and Cheap Trick for me. Those are the two. There are other bands that mean so much to me. Who's going to, you know, Fugazi, there's a ton of others, but those two for me from top to bottom are just like, you know, like it moves me. And so it's just, and we were talking about like trying to become a better musician and learning. I learned a lot learning those songs, just the arrangements. And Peter Buck has such an unusual approach to the guitar, and it's a fantastic experience. And so we'll see if people want to see it in other cities. A little bit nervous.
Well, I think it's going to be great.
I hope so.
I don't know how to put this because it's not true. I don't know why I never saw REM, but when I did see them, it was too late. I saw them at Rosemont and it was just too big. But the reason I went was because Robin Hitchcock was opening.
And he's amazing.
Huge Robin Hitchcock fan.
Yeah.
I walked out of that concert going, these are two of my favorite bands that I should have seen in a small, intimate place.
Yeah, I know.
Not the Rosemont Horizon.
I know. I didn't see REM until it was at the Greek Theater in like 2002 or something. They were still incredible. Wilco opened up, and that's how I got in, through friends who worked for the band. Yeah, it was amazing. But yeah, it's not like, I don't know if this was your experience, but in 1987, we were all huge Replacements fans, and my friends got back from a they went to see them at the Riviera, and I didn't go. And so I'm talking to my friends the next morning in high school. I'm like, how was the show? And they said, well, the Replacements came out and did a song, and they couldn't get through it. So they started another song, and then they couldn't get through it. So then they tried a cover song, couldn't get through it. And they tried another cover song. And then after four half songs, Paul Westerberg said, well, you paid for three bands and you got two, and they walked off. And I thought, maybe it was 86. I was like, I'm never going to go see that band. I regret that. I regret that. But fortunately got to play some shows with them when they reunited, and it was fantastic. But yeah, you can be a fan, but you can't see every band. I'm still learning about bands in our orbit that I just didn't even know about.
I am too. Yeah. This is all stuff I would have loved to known about for all these years, but you can't know everything. I think I even heard you say in an interview that it gets to the point too, where you're not even going to many concerts because you're playing concerts. So you get intimate with up and coming bands and intimate with bands that you play with.
Yeah.
And they become your favorites to listen to because, you know, you get to know them, you love the music. And then all this other stuff just kind of flies by. And
yeah, we're busy with family and busy with other projects. And yeah,
you can answer this on what level you want, personal or just a simple answer. But I'm really watching your kids and you with them. I love watching relationships of like families together and seeing them and the intricacies of it, the humor that you could share with the divide of, you know, parent child. You know, you have to have rebellions in that too. But I was curious as to how you balance that with your wife on being tour so much. There must be like deep conversations about what you owe to them when you get back or something, you know. Is it just work magically for you, or is that, it seems like someone who's so busy as you have to really negotiate time?
Well, you know, maybe I met my wife when she was 19 and I was 21, so she knew what this guy was going to be doing, you know, like, it has never changed. It's always been the same. It wasn't like, you know, 10 years in, I'm like, oh, I'm going to be a touring musician, you know, like, and really like the secret sauce to that, I think, not, on a personal level, but like, it looks like I'm touring all the time and I'm just not. Like, if the Bob Mould Band does a US tour, it's maybe 3.5 weeks and we're in Chicago for a couple days or 3 days in the middle. And we don't do those that often. And if we go to Europe, it's maybe 2 weeks, 3 weeks. We go to Australia, it's maybe 10 days. South America, same thing. You know, all these, there are bands that tour for 3 months at a time. I've never been in one. So I think it was 2013 was the most touring I've ever done. Superchunk and Bob Mould both went to Australia. Bob Mould Band went to South America. We both went to Europe 3 times, 2 US tours, festivals, one-offs. At the end of the year, my wife and I added up the time, and I was gone 27% of the time. That's not a lot. That's like a wedding photographer. So that helps. That's, you know, I have empathy for these bands that, you know, they have families and they go out for months at a time. I don't know that I could have ever done that. I've said no to bands because of that. And then that said, I think my kids are used to it. I mean, there's only one at home still. With my wife, certainly sometimes I'll get home and she'll be like, your turn. You know? not in like a, you know, you owe me this or vengeance, but just sort of like, I'm pretty exhausted. You know, do you feel like, you know? That's a good question, but I think we're fortunate in that nobody in our family is shocked or alarmed by what I do. And in fact, I think my youngest is about to turn 14, and she's maybe now even enjoying some of the perks of, she loved this band. And I was like, well, you know, do you want to see them? And so I got to take her to see the band. She met the band. So she's like, okay, you know, I don't always get along with my dad. You know, I'm a teenager, but this is pretty cool. Stuff like that. Yeah. I think I've been fortunate in that way based on how I've seen some years ago musicians who, it's tough. Like, not everybody's built for that. Not everybody's built for touring themselves. I mean, you want to talk about anxiety. If you have anxiety and it's the hurry up and wait schedule, it's brutal. It's just brutal. And then if you have somebody at home who has anxiety, separation anxiety, it can be tough. And so I've seen it. I've seen it firsthand. Fortunately, that's not my experience. But again, I'm not, I've never gone that long.
That was a difficulty with Weasel, which eventually drove me and Ben apart, is that the understanding of the anxiety, but then the reality of what it was causing the band to happen in the band, I couldn't rationalize, like, because I love performing and he didn't want to perform at all, or he'd book a tour and I'd get even in blackouts to be the free supporting band where we would do all the merch. And then he'd cancel it, you know, like a week before we go, and everyone quit their jobs and stuff. So it became really frustrating.
Exhausting. Yeah. It's really trying. Yeah.
I thought you did that really cool video with Steve Albini that I liked of being in the studio, like about how his intricacies get, expand.
What a good sport.
I'm a big fan of Steve Albini. He's been on the show a couple of times.
Cool.
We did one with Naked Reg, and then I did just an interview of him, and then I did one of Big Black, which was
you amazing. Thought I talked a lot.
Yeah, he does. Yeah.
He's a good talker. He's a good talker.
He's a very good talker.
He's very smart. Yeah, he's very smart.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I mean, that whole thing was like, I just thought it would be so funny if I walked into the studio and Steve was like, what's in the bag? You know, it's food. And then he wants to take stock of it.
I've been recording a lot over at Electrical Audio.
Oh, yeah. Steve Albini.
Steve's place.
Mm-hmm. Harsh taskmaster, then, Mr. Albini.
He has new rules.
New rules? What now?
Jason, I just want to go over the refrigerator protocol with you. Sauces and marinades in the door, those are mine. Would you be using those?
No, thank you. I brought in some roast beef and Swiss cheese.
When you say Swiss, is that Lorraine, raclette, baby?
You know, bread doesn't become toast by itself. You have to toast it.
So he writes all the food down?
Every food item I bring into the studio, he has to mark it down.
They're so organized over there in a beautiful way. I mean, I'm there all the time. I love that studio. I love everybody there. It's a fantastic place to work. But I just love that he embraced exaggerating his personality.
No, he seems like someone that would do that. I guess the curiosity for me was, and this goes back, so the audience knows too, that there Albini has actually even talked about, I mean, way back when you had Fur Bolton, he actually brought them up, the two. So there's a sort of relationship over time. But what I was curious is, looking at all your records, I couldn't see one where he actually engineered or produced. Is that not, I mean, you've worked at the studio many times. Mm-hmm. You've never worked together in a creative?
We've worked together a lot, but it's been interesting. Like, for instance, there was some Apple TV show, it was called Glow Girls or something, with Amy Brenneman, where they hired us. You know, there was a Christian rock band in the show, and they sent the actors to the studio. And I love that Electrical did this, but they're like, Steve's engineering it. I think they want somebody to kind of like talk to the actors. And so I was kind of brought in as like the middle person, you know, like, this is the song. This is what we need to achieve. Steve's going to worry about sounds and setting up microphones and stuff. And I did more of like the personality managing stuff. And we did that. I played bass on a Robbie Fulks record that Steve engineered. And then there's been a bunch of smaller projects. We're about to do another one in December where it's a singer-songwriter who's excited about making a record and working with Steve. And again, like, they don't really have a band. So I bring in musicians and work on arrangements and just kind of like, for lack of a better word, like musical director, to record a band live with this singer-songwriter. And Steve gets his amazing sounds and mixes the record, and we work together that way. And that's really fun. You know, I love working with him that way, but it is interesting for all these years.
Yeah.
I mean, the first time I met Steve was when Dave Grohl interviewed me for Sonic Highways, the HBO show, in 2013, 2014. That was the first time I met Steve.
Cubby Bear was first real show I played.
I was 11 or something. I'll never forget the first time my dad and I pull up in front of Cubby Bear and a drug deal is going down and cops came in and busted the kids. And we just sat in the car and waited because we weren't going to get out while that was happening. And I remember thinking, this is fucking great.
And I think Steve even said it. We kind of ran into each other in the lounge and he's like, hey, I'm like, hey, he's like, we have a lot of mutual friends. I'm like, we sure do. You know, like, nice to see you. Like, yeah, but it's interesting. None of the projects, I mean, with Split Single, I work with Taylor Hales, who's the studio manager in Electrical Audio. And this is no diss on Steve or like, you know, he's amazing, but this is Taylor's the one that I work with. And then with the Bob Mould Band, we've made a number of records at Electrical Audio and we have our own engineer, Bo Sorensen. So it's like, Steve always comes in, we get hugs and we catch up and it's always fun, but it is interesting that we don't, I would love to make a record with Steve and I get to, but not with my own stuff.
Well, thanks for talking about that. Cause I thought it was very curious that you two had this, it looked like a nice relationship. And I was like, I wonder why they had never recorded. Like
we actually work together a lot. It's just not the higher profile projects.
Yeah. No, yeah. I think that's
like, if it's a TV show, they don't list at the end, like Jason Narduzzi and Steve Albini worked on the Christian band scene or whatever.
What I really like about the audience that I've nurtured is that even though I come from a punk background and I interview a lot of punk people, I often don't even go there because I feel like learning about where punk comes from is more about talking about people, about their lives and who they are and just their passions. And that, to me, that almost speaks more to it than actually talking about punk. Yeah. But I do want to acknowledge that you did have an effect on a lot of people that saw you when you were young and they, that excitement, like Dave Grohl, and it says it's his cousin, but it was actually a friend that was seen as a cousin or something. That was, well, Tracy, right?
His mom and Tracy's mom were college roommates and they were very, very close. And so it's kind of, I don't know if you have family like that where they say, oh, it's your uncle, but it's not.
So they
called each other cousins for years and years. And then sometimes in interviews, they'll be like, well, we're not really cousins. But they're in touch all the time. I mean, like, you know,
yeah
it's a close, it's pretty cool. Tracy's very charismatic, you know, like, and so is Dave, and so like there's these magnets with them that's really funny to watch.
Yeah, and I just want to acknowledge other crossovers we won't be able to talk about, but I guess John Ross Bowie threw in a nice word about me.
Oh, I love John. Talk. Yeah
me too. And I just discovered him a year ago too, and we became kind of friends.
You want to talk about a punk rock student.
Yeah.
He's a punk rock student. He wrote this great, did he ever tell you about the Ramones play that he wrote?
Yeah. It opened. I didn't get to see it, but I know about it.
It opened in Chicago and he invited my wife and I and we went. It was so good. He's massively talented. Yeah, he and I can go on and on and on about punk rock.
He actually was in a band called, everyone probably knows, is Egghead.
Yep.
There goes my neighborhood pop reader. You know that I'm her biggest fan.
They just reunited, yeah, with his bum foot. Felt so bad for him. He's on stage and it's just like, ugh.
Oh man, I didn't know about that.
Talk about a guy who really, like, I feel like his heart is open and his mind is open and he wants to learn more and just a passionate music listener and music lover. I like being in touch with people like that a lot.
Yeah, and his theater upbringing is great too, and the work that he does that I've seen him in, he's so super funny. I mean, I can't remember. I'm going to kill myself later, but I'll have the future John come in because I can't remember that.
Here we go. I love his future. Jason is ready for future John. Future John, what do you have?
Do you remember the name of his sitcom that got canceled?
With Minnie Driver. This is Sleepless. No.
Yeah. What is it? It's funny because I watch it quite often.
The first time he and I met was in Chicago. He was staying at a hotel near where the Ramones musical was. And we were walking around and we were kind of hungry. And we went into Water Power Place, which, you know, is like, you know, super packed mall, downtown touristy thing. And we sat down in this food court and this guy walked up to John. It was a beautiful, beautiful moment where he told him how much that sitcom meant to him because he has a son who's handicapped and special needs. And that's, you know, it's one of the Sleepless. It's not called Sleepless. God, I'm ready for
current John here. The show is called Speechless.
Speechless. Much better title. Don't let me name your band.
It actually has something to do with the actual content of the show. As we're Sleepless, it's not really discussed.
Not at all. and I was moved by this interaction. Of course, I just sat there silent, and John was great with the guy, and then he took off. And then a week later, that guy messaged me on social media, and he's like, "It just occurred to me that it was you sitting with John Ross Bowie. I'm a bigger fan of you than I am of John. I'm sorry that I ignored you." It's like, no. That was such a beautiful moment. And that's the power of being creative. You know, when John could be a part of a project like that, that spoke to people who felt alone or felt not represented. Punk rock does that when it's done great.
Right. And I think I'm not going to say it's just punk rock, because some people that are like this are led to punk rock, but there's in that show is that it's not protected. Like, they're willing to take a little chances with how they're treating. Yes. It's uncomfortable
and funny.
And that's to me, that's how you can balance comedy and seriousness is you have to get to those uncomfortable spots.
Absolutely. It's so much more powerful when that happens. Yeah. Yes. Absolutely. Thank you for bringing up John. He's a beautiful soul.
If you are interested to know more about John Ross Bowie, he is on episode 125 of Jughead's Basement.
Where I want to end it with is I just want to go a little Bob Mould, because he's always been a figure in my life. That I always tell people that when we were on tour, when we did tour with Weasel, Ben usually didn't like music in the van, but the only things he would allow in the van, or actually we traveled in a Chevy Malibu back then.
Nice.
Chevy Malibu. The only thing that allowed was Double Nickels on the Dime, Zen Arcade, and It's Alive by the Ramones. Those were the only albums that we could listen to, which they were all double albums. So that kind of helped. So I'd be amiss to even to end this interview without. Oh, no. That's funny. I was just about to say to end the interview without talking about it. And then now he's gone.
John in the future here, and I contemplated cutting this out, but it seems to fit into the conversation with me and Jason. So this pause, me waiting for Jason, went on for about 10 minutes.
Absolutely incredibly embarrassing. Sorry about that.
I've already checked out.
You should.
I was about to say one of the most important things I've ever said on the podcast, and then we lost it.
And then it all ended. Yeah.
All right.
Can't really capture it.
No.
Future Jason here, really, really regretting not planning ahead by plugging in my phone before a podcast. You see, I've never done a podcast before.
So I spilled my guts about the Double Nickels, Zen Arcade, It's Alive situation. How? What I'm trying to get at is that I was trying to think of some interesting way to get to Bob Mould in here that isn't repeating stuff that you've said so many times. And I don't have a way in, except for I know that, you know, it must have been amazing for him to have come and produced your record. I mean, being a fan for so long and then playing with him. I mean, he's one of the best in the world to me.
Totally.
So I feel I need to talk about that relationship, but I don't know how.
I mean, him producing Verbo in 96 was I mean, we were in Austin, Texas. He lived there at the time. And just little things. Here's something I don't think I've ever talked about in a podcast. I had a Stratocaster that was an American Stratocaster, but not an upscale one, not one of his like really nice lace sensor pickup Strats. Mm-hmm. I had just kind of like your standard American Strat, and it had its quirks. And he just showed me this really simple thing that he's like, may I? I was like, yes, please. You know, he puts my guitar on and you're just like, ah. So he has it in the lead, you know, the bridge position pickup. And then he takes the tone from 10 and puts it on 5. Magical. Like the sound, it's right in that Cheap Trick Sugar pocket. And just little things like that, that he knew how to do and how to manipulate distortion pedals and amps. And I mean, I think I used a Fender Princeton on that record. It's this tiny little tube amp with distortion pedal and a tuner, and that was it. And he's really good at, if you listen to that first Verbo record, he's really good at, he knew I was a Cheap Trick fan, and he's a massive Cheap Trick fan. And he was like, you know what Tom Werman used to do on those Cheap Trick records? I was like, what? And he's like, we're going to do an overdub where when we get to the last verse, I know I've never talked about this stuff, so you're getting some stuff here. When we get to the last verse, we're going to do these guitar stabs on the snare drum. And sure enough, I went back to those old Cheap Trick records, and he's totally does that. So you get to that part, every time the snare, down, down, down. And it just like, you can't hear it specifically, but you feel it. And it just is this lift, this sonic lift. I love those like particulates on records where it's like, what is that? He's so good at that. He'd like have me play acoustic guitar on a bridge and just do single note, dun, 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 and then put the Eventide, you know, harmonizer on it. And it would just be way in the background in stereo. And you just feel this lush thing. You don't know what it is, but it's a new event that just created this new soundscape. And he's a genius at that. And there was just endless examples of him doing things like that, where you hope that you retain half of it and use it for something else, you know?
Yeah, I like hearing that's the type of producer you ended up being, because there are cases where someone just comes in because their name gets put on and it helps and they know it's going to help. But it sounds like he really had an effect on what you chose to do and how to sound like.
And also being really good at, so there's a song called Holiday, which we kind of knew would be the first single. It was very catchy. And he's like in the, and I don't even know what part of the song this would be, but like it's right after the chorus. And I just don't even know what you'd call that, post chorus or something, but it's basically it's first fret capo, but it's like a C sharp minor to A9, not considering the capo. And on that, he's like on that C sharp minor, you could do like a guitar line that would fill up that space. It'd be a nice decoration in that spot. Mm-hmm. And of course I'm like, waiting for him to write the part and I'll play it, because that's what you want as a kid, you know. Yeah. But he was like, go in the other room and come up with a bunch of things. And so I'd come back and he's like, not quite there, go back, come back, you're onto something there. And so he, you know, encouraged me, as a great producer would, to come up with that part. So you know, the years go on and you take pride in writing that part, but he's the one who's like, you need something else there. So I thought that was so cool, because he could very easily come up with a better part, you know, like he's right. Bob Mould. Yeah. He's an amazing guitar player, but he wanted me to come up with something for myself.
Jason, you might not even be able to answer this, but this is one of the things, after listening to your catalog and knowing that you work in other people's bands and you feel the duty, you do a great job, they love having you, you do your own music, been doing it for so long. And this is a question I ask about myself about creativity, it drives me crazy. Is being unique important? And do you get frustrated with emulation, or are you okay with having something sound like something else? It's just, I don't know how to, I get at the key of the conversation I'm saying, but it is a ongoing creative frustration and also excitement to me to be inspired and to sound like someone. But also there's that part of me that drives me a little nuts where I'm like, oh, it's got to be different. It's got to be something to it has to be different, but it still needs to come from me. And the reason I brought it up is because you said that thing about Bob Mould, about you doing the part. And that reminded me of that question about uniqueness. And does that come into your mind when you're writing or you're creating?
I mean, you're talking to someone that, you know, as an 11-year-old was playing punk rock in 1983 when, you know, my friends didn't understand that. Then I released an acoustic record with a cellist in 1994, you know, and then made a rock record in 97 when it was all imploding. So I obviously don't, it's not, maybe I could stand to be more calculated. I don't know, but no, I just tend to, and then later now I'm just trying to write. I really feel like the thing for me is to try to write a strong song. I feel like songs are that's the way to feel. I feel the best when I'm like, this song feels good, or, you know, and I play it live and I get that feedback, or I really like play it for a friend and they like it. That's the best, you know, like somebody whose opinion you admire. But uniqueness is tricky because you also don't want to fall into like, well, is this a ploy to get, you know, like some attention or something. We were talking about Morphine. I think that's I just played them for a friend of mine who had never heard them. And I'm like, check that out. You know, that's a fretless bass, an amazing lead vocalist. And, you know, Dana's playing two saxophones at the same time. You know, like drummer's great. I mean, they were so unique. They were so unique.
And he only used three strings. My sister just told me two. He didn't use four in his bass, right? Oh, two.
Two.
Oh, she said three.
And
oh,
the
so
only
it was two.
Way I know that is because he was friends with Presidents of the United States of America, the Seattle band, and they did the same thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Two strings, fretless. Yeah.
That reminds me of a quick story, and then I'll let you go. But there's at Batteries Not Included. I'll bring it back around. we one night we played with a band called Funeral Bitch. Because, you know, you were with, you know, they had different types of bands back then that would be on one bill. And this guy, the bass player, had his amps like on 12 or 13, but he also only had E strings. He had four bass E strings.
And what kind of sound did that produce?
And it was,
oh, so he wasn't barring them. He wasn't playing them together. He was doing mixed. Oh.
Yeah, and it was just like, it was such the heaviest, loudest sound I had ever heard in a small venue before.
Wow.
I don't know if the technique was one of thought through. I think it was more like, no one's ever done this. It's going to be loud and, and ridiculous.
We're still talking about it. 40 plus years later, we're still talking about it. No, I mean, it's funny that Morphine show that we played at First Avenue, Morphine was crazy loud. I did not expect that. They were so loud. It was great, but it was like, did not expect that band to be massively loud. They sure were.
Yeah. My sister mostly came from the metal scene, like Motley Crue before she moved out to Boston. And that was the band for her that just rocked her world. She became friends with them. And then when he passed
away,
it was
very upset. Yeah. Mark Sandman. Yeah.
Yeah.
Treat Her Right. Was that Mark's band before Morphine? I think.
I don't know.
It's worth checking out because it's still his voice. You know, it's a different presentation, but he's got that beautiful. He had that beautiful smoky voice.
All them big feet, step, stepping on my toes. Hey, I got a gun. Know how to use it. I got a gun. Now you know. I got a gun. Know how to use it. I got a gun. Now you know.
The one thing I want to clarify just with Jason, when I was talking about uniqueness, I didn't mean like, you were talking about being out of time, but to me that too, that is still unique to be out of time, but it wasn't about like popularity or anything like that. But like, for instance, I'll clarify, like I have a couple of musician friends, even one who's a producer, and he knows so much about music. And when we're in the studio, he can nitpick and make us sound better and, you know, add vocal parts we wouldn't have thought about. But he, for the life of me, he can't create his own song because he like checks himself every time he does it. Like, oh, that's been done, or that those two don't work together well. And I'm constantly going things. I don't care if they work together. That's what, you know, we're doing.
Yeah.
that's what my brain says to do.
Yeah.
So I guess that's, it harkens with this idea of knowing too much, but then also there's a creative part that just takes those disparate things and makes something happen. And that's, to me, where if you're going to be unique or genuine, that's where some of that comes out of.
Yeah. And it's kind of freeing being, 52 years old and just being like, I'm just going to do what I do. And it's either going to be small or a little bit bigger than small. You know, as far as like reach, you know, like you're not shooting for the stars in the same way that you are when you're 22, or maybe you're not, but like you at least think that it's wide open and a possibility. And now it's like, I'm totally comfortable with having this, you know, little following that, do these shows. And I don't know. It's freeing. It's very freeing to just kind of like be like, this is the type of record I want to make right now. And so that's what I'm going to do.
Well, I just wanted to know your prints are everywhere, and I acknowledge it now.
I appreciate that, John. I'm so glad we met. Yes. I really appreciate you reaching out. Yeah.
Yeah. So thank you very much. And I hope I didn't lose this. I think it's okay.
Great chat. I'm sorry about all the edits. and hopefully you can consolidate so it's not 2 hours.
Yeah. It makes, well, I do, Future John does a lot of editing. So.
Okay, good. Present.
It's in his hands now.
Present Jason appreciates that.
All right, sir. When I hang up, that's an actual hang up. So we'll be done when I. Oh my God! We.
And scene.
Goodbye.
See you, John.
Did they need it?
If you have made it this far, you just got done listening to 95% by Split Single off their album Amplificado, which came out in 2021. Thank you, everybody, for listening. I really enjoyed that. What a guy. I think we hit a lot of ground, and I'm very impressed and happy with our ability to speak to each other in a creative and exhilarating way. So thank you, Jason. Thank you very much. And thank you, everybody, for listening. Remember, go to Patreon and become a patron member and help the show to grow and to keep producing for as long as I can still talk. Or eventually I can use ChatGPT and have it talk for me. God forbid. Next up, I am very excited about this. I have no idea how it's going to go. I'm interviewing him in about a day or two. But I will be interviewing Mike Cesario, who I was introduced to by my friend Polly Van Dam. Mike is the founder of Liquid Death, which, if you don't know, is a canned water company. And its tagline is, "Murder your thirst." So stay tuned for that. If you have any suggestions of who you want to be on my show, and even better, so much more, if you have a connection to this person that you would like on the show, please email me at jugheadsbasement@gmail.com. There it is. See you next time.